from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. This morning on Forum, we take up the two big stories that are dominating this morning's news in the Bay Area, the BART strike and the wildfire in the Santa Cruz Mountains. We'll look into what it means for traffic if BART workers follow through on their plans to strike Monday morning and get some ideas on how commuters can contend with what could be a huge traffic headache. And then we'll also get the latest on the fire near Bonny Doon that has now scorched over 4,000 acres and forced the evacuation of over 2,000 residents. The BART strike and fire, next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome to Forum. Our focus this morning, the two big stories that are dominating the news in the Bay Area today, the potential BART strike and fire. As you know, one of three unions representing BART workers have called for a strike to begin Monday morning. The agency's other unionized workers say they'll respect those picket lines, and that means that unless there's a dramatic breakthrough in the next 72 hours, commuters will be without BART come Monday morning. In a moment, we'll hear what that will mean for Bay Area traffic and explore some commuter alternatives as well. But we want to start with a fire update, the fire in the Santa Cruz Mountains that is now just about 5% contained. It's burning not far from where a fire struck in that same region just a year ago. So far, the fire has burned over 4,000 acres and forced the evacuation of over 2,000 residents. KQED's Peter John Schuler is on the scene this morning. Peter, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you very much.
Give us the latest about what's going on. You are in Davenport, which is not far from where the fire is currently burning. What's the latest you can tell us about what the situation is there?
Well, just a couple of miles away, really, and it's very strange. This is on Highway 1. I look in one direction, I see blue skies, the ocean. I turn around behind me, and it's very smoky. Ash is falling on the cars here. There were some firefighters who had been here all night. They had just pulled out for a much-needed rest, and they said they'd been working all night just to try to keep the fire away from structures, away from homes.
Now, there were reports this morning that there had been two structures so far damaged, not homes, actually. Are you hearing anything more about what the situation is in terms of homes being endangered?
At this point, there have been no homes reported hurt or destroyed. This is what they're doing. They're trying to fight a defensive battle against this fire. That's why there's so little contained. They're just waiting near homes, keeping it away from the homes and letting it burn through and letting it burn past and just protecting the homes.
And in terms of the evacuees, people have been evacuated both from Bonny Doon, which is a small community, 3-4 miles or so inland, and also from Davenport, right? So are the only people in Davenport right now emergency workers, fire workers who are getting off duty, those going back on?
No, for the most part, Davenport is down here far enough from the fire that this is kind of where people are gathering. People from the Bonny Doon area who were evacuated spent the night. I spoke to one woman who spent the night with some friends, and she was just here getting some coffee and getting ready to go to work in Santa Cruz.
We're going to hear from someone from CAL FIRE in just a moment, but any sense yet, Peter, of how people feel about this? This is something that you live with if you live in that region. They went through this, of course, just a year ago. Do you have a sense of people feeling resilient about it, that once this is done, they'll go back? Or are you getting a feeling at all for people saying, this is it, I'm out of here?
That's an interesting question because the woman I talked to said, you know, they told us when we moved here that this could happen at any time. We were evacuated last year. We were evacuated again this year. It's sad. You worry. But this is part of living where we want to live.
Peter John Schuler on the scene in Davenport, not far from the fire this morning. Peter, we'll listen for your reports on KQED throughout the day. Thanks for being there. Thanks for joining us so far this morning.
Thank you.
Daniel Berlant joins us now. He's a spokesman for CAL FIRE. Daniel, can you give us the latest, please, on what we know about the state of containment? Reports this morning that it was 5% contained. That doesn't sound like much, but of course it's better than zero, which is where it was last night. What's the progress report that you can give us about how the fire is being contained?
Well, the fire is 5% contained. Like you said, it doesn't sound like much, but what I can tell you is that firefighters made good progress last night in building that containment line. We still have a lot of work that needs to be done, but progress is being made. Even though 5% doesn't sound like much, it is looking a lot better.
And what's allowing you to make things look better? You got some help, I know, from the weather last night, that winds died down. Is that primarily what's been allowed you to make some progress?
Well, the weather has definitely been a huge factor in assisting us. With the strong onshore winds that we had, the wind was pushing the fire toward the Bonnie Doon community. As those winds dissipated around midnight, that allowed our firefighters to really get in there, make a stand, building line around the fire, around homes in the Bonnie Doon area. So we're taking advantage of the lack of wind, but really the weather conditions, everything being so dry, have allowed this fire to really burn very actively.
And what's the prospect for weather today? I know it's supposed to be warm. I know there's no coastal fog at the moment. Is that what it all comes down to really right now, what the weather will be like?
Well, the weather is expected to remain favorable this morning, but we are looking at a possible transition in our weather pattern sometime this afternoon. That could mean that the wind will shift and actually move the fire more into the western direction, back near the community of Swanton. So that's why one of the reasons that we're working so actively right now and making sure those containment lines are strong around Swanton. In case that fire does shift, we're standing ready for it to move back towards this area.
Swanton, another small rural community not far from Bonnie Doon. Are you guardedly optimistic then, Daniel, at this point about protecting homes?
You know, firefighters have been doing a great job throughout the last 24 hours of protecting the homes. There's hundreds of homes throughout Bonnie Doon, Swanton, even some remote locations outside of Davenport. But unfortunately, the good news is that no homes have actually been damaged or destroyed. And knowing how quickly this fire was burning yesterday, that's really good news. So we're very optimistic that things will remain this way. But really, the factor is the weather and the wind. It's very hard to predict exactly what Mother Nature is going to do. So right now, we just continue to actively work in case the weather, you know, changes later this afternoon.
And what about the state of your resources, state of person power that you have? How many firefighters are you bringing in, equipment from around the area? What's the latest with what you can tell us about whether or not you have enough person power to do what you need to do?
Yeah, well, we have over 670 firefighters on scene, hundreds more en route from across California. In the initial stages of this wildfire, due to the fact that it was just burning so aggressively, we right away called in additional resources. Fire engines were dispatched in the middle of the night yesterday to come to Santa Cruz area. As those fire engines start to arrive now, we'll put them right to work, put them on the line, allowing some of the crews that have been out there for 24 hours plus since this fire started, allowing them to get some rest so that they can get back out there later in the day or even tomorrow sometime. So we definitely have a lot of firefighters battling this blaze.
In that sense, Daniel, are we awfully lucky that despite this being the third year of dry conditions, that the fire season to date has actually been surprisingly mild? If you were stretched thinner, if there were more fires going on all across the state, you probably wouldn't have those resources, right?
You know, one of the things to remember is that in California, we have what's called the Master Mutual Aid System, which means that fire agencies are able to call upon each other in a major disaster. So when there's a fire in a certain area, like the fire in Bonnie Doon, we were able to quickly call on resources from not only CAL FIRE, but also resources from the local government, Santa Cruz County, Monterey County, but even fire engines as far as Southern California were quickly able to get on the road and come up this way to help us out. You know, one of the things we have to remember, in California, we're used to having lots of fires at one time. It's just one of those natural disasters that we often get. And so we are staffed, we are ready to go, prepared to be able to respond to multiple incidents at one time. But like you mentioned, this has been somewhat of a moderate start to the fire season. But there is that potential, like we're seeing today and throughout the next couple months, of more damaging wildfires because things are just so dry.
And speaking of that potential, another fire, of course, going on in the Bay Area region today in Alameda near Tracy. Can you give us any updated information on where that one stands?
Well, that fire has now burned 5,000 acres, is 40% contained. That area is very open grasslands. There were a few ranches in the area last night. Fortunately, no evacuations were needed. The number of fires that we have right now really goes to show how dry things are. It does not take much for a simple spark to quickly become a major wildfire.
Daniel Berlin, spokesman for CAL FIRE, joining us on the scene, providing us with the latest on what's going on with both the fire in the Santa Cruz Mountains and the one burning currently near Tracy. Daniel, thanks for the update. Good luck today.
Thank you.
Daniel Berlant and earlier Peter John Schuler bringing us the latest. We'll continue to be following those stories on KQED throughout the day, bringing you reports on that. We'll give you more on that as it develops, also Monday morning on Forum. We want to turn, though, now to the other big story that is dominating the news this morning, and that's the possibility, perhaps likelihood, of a strike that has been called by BART workers for Monday morning. We want to get the latest on where that stands, whether or not there's any possibility that the strike will be resolved before it goes into effect Monday morning. Joining us to provide us with that update, Rachel Gordon. She is a reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. We'll be hearing from Rachel in just a bit. On the phone with us already, though, Harley Shaken, professor of labor and global economics, who tracks labor disputes not only here in California but around the country. Professor Shaken, thanks for taking time out to join us this morning.
Very nice to be here.
And John Goodwin joins us as well. He's spokesman for the Metropolitan Transportation Commission. The MTC is the commission that does transportation planning, coordinating, and financing for the 9-county San Francisco Bay Area. John, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome. Good morning.
Harley, first, what do you hear about the status of the talks? Nothing formal that we know of going on right now, but you do get this sense that there's still time, 70 hours or whatever it is, counting until Monday morning, that something could still happen. Do you have any sense, insight into the possibilities that a strike could still be averted?
Well, it certainly could still be averted. It has gone from possible to probable to even likely at this point. It doesn't look good, but that's not the same as saying it's inevitable. There's more than enough time to settle. You don't have the cataclysmic large issues that often result in large strikes. This wasn't a strike that was a strategic move by the unions or by BART, but rather a strike that happened because the workers, the members of the Amalgamated Transit Union were dissatisfied with the contract. They're feeling the same pressures everyone else in the Bay Area is feeling concerning living costs and the weak economy, but they voted it down. So we're at a point now where there's apparently an impasse. They're not talking. But as the reality of what a strike would mean right now begins to sink in the next hours, we could see some movement.
We'll get to some of those realities in a moment. But give us some insight, too, if you would, Professor Shaken, about the situation here with really three unions in play. You mentioned the Amalgamated Transportation Union. They're the ones who are going to go out on strike. But there are two other unions in play, both AFSCME and SEIU, two other agencies that represent both service workers and state, county, and municipal employees. They approve the contract, but they say they will respect the strike that's now being called by the actual transit drivers and stationed agents. Do you sense any tension between those unions?
There's been no public tension. There's bound to be some internal feelings that aren't being publicly expressed. One of the things that's surprising about the negotiations to date is the unions worked very well together in terms of coordinating their strategies. Clearly, there's always differences internally, and the members appeared to be very much in tune with the leaders. When they called for tentative strike votes, they were getting 98% vote for that. It's a sort of a counterexample. In Seattle several years ago, when the machinists called for a strike vote, they got 60-some-odd percent. But The leadership of all three unions accepted the agreement that was signed several days ago. The first two unions, that is the service employees and AFSCME, did ratify it. The ATU, their members voted it down 2-1. So now we've got a situation that is somewhat confused. The strike is by one union, but the largest union had already accepted, and AFSCME, which is a union of several hundred managers and others at BART, also accepted, both by overwhelming margins. For AFSCME, 86%. For the SEIU, I think it was 3-4-1. So you had strong acceptance by their workers. You had the one union that's holding out, but everyone has said they will respect the picket line. So if a strike does occur, it means that BART will be shut down, but there is undoubtedly internal discussions among the unions as to where to go because all their members are impacted.
Right. We'll get back to some of those labor issues and some of the other prospects as we go forward over the course of the hour. But John Goodwin, give us a sense of what commuters now have to really be thinking about, given that the prospects for a strike, as Professor Shaken has mentioned, have moved from probable to more likely. What is your first line of advice or defense that commuters at this point should be considering?
You know, my first line of advice is plan ahead. It's great that we've got a couple of days to prepare for this. I certainly urge workers to make arrangements with their employers if possible to work a flexible schedule, perhaps telecommute if possible. We would like ideally to shift as many trips away from the peak morning and afternoon commute times and spread this anticipated much heavier load on Bay Area roadways across a broader part of the day.
And that particular struggle that could happen for commuters is particularly acute, of course, at the rush hour time. Give us a sort of real nuts and bolts sense of that. How many extra cars are there likely to be if you begin your commute at 7:30 in the morning come Monday?
Yeah, we did a little back of the envelope calculation the other day and expect Transbay traffic to increase by about 60,000 vehicles each day, with maybe a third of that or 20,000 vehicles coming during the morning peak. Spread that out over 4 hours, you've got 5,000 additional vehicles per hour. That's kind of meaningless until you consider that the Bay Bridge has a capacity of 10,000 vehicles per hour. So if all those trips are concentrated in the Bay Bridge corridor, and of course they won't be, presumably some are going to take the Dumbarton Bridge, some will take the San Mateo Bridge, others Richmond-San Rafael Bridge over to the Golden Gate Bridge. But the impact is going to be big, and it'll be felt really throughout much of the region. So we really want people to plan ahead, particularly to carpool if possible. We're urging folks to use the 511 system. Go online to 511.org. There's an online ride matching tool. Avail yourself of the great Bay Area tradition of casual carpooling if that works for you. Just make plans and be prepared for some inconvenience. And I think that probably is the bottom line. This is going to be an inconvenience for a lot of people. This is not going to be a catastrophe, but it is going to be an imposition on a lot of folks.
And just one point on the 511.org tool. You mentioned Ride Match. That's something that can allow you, if you don't normally carpool or if you're normally someone who relies on BART, you can use that to actually find someone in your area that you could ride with?
That's exactly correct.
Okay, John Goodwin joining us and will stay with us to answer your questions throughout the hour today about how to deal with the strike if it goes out on Monday. John is with the Metropolitan Transportation Commission. Harley Shaken with us as well from the University of California, Berkeley. And joining us now, too, Rachel Gordon, who's been tracking this story for the San Francisco Chronicle. Rachel, anything new this morning in terms of any movement that you're sensing about the possibility of the two sides still trying to work together?
There was a great determination voiced by both sides yesterday, and it's going to carry through, I would guess, through Sunday night of trying to get this settled at the negotiating table. As was mentioned, the negotiations have been going on since April 1st, and it seems that as we go every day that there seems to be more of an intent to get something done. This is the closest we've come to a strike with the actual strike date set. I think what's going to be most interesting to see is what politicians decide to get involved. We saw Governor Schwarzenegger refusing yesterday to call for a cooling off period, a 60-day cooling off period, but kind of urged both sides to get to the table. That's a nice political, you know, urging is a nice, easy way for politicians to say to do something. Mayor Dellums in Oakland, Mayor Newsom from San Francisco also are trying to get people to the table. We haven't seen anyone step up yet and say, I'm going to be the one, the savior, who's going to come in and get both sides to work together. But I'm sure we're going to see that soon, as we've seen in past years when there have been BART labor disputes, that it's the politicians who've kind of come in at the end, not necessarily the elected BART board directors, but the other elected leaders from the East Bay, San Francisco, to try to forge an agreement.
And Harley Shaken, round off what Rachel is saying about what the governor actually could do. It doesn't sound like he's going to, but this idea of a cooling off period that the governor can impose, what gives him the legal clout to do that? Do governors ever exercise that possibility?
Oh, they certainly do, but rarely. I think Rachel expressed it very well. The politicians to date are seeking to avoid this. They don't want to become casualties of a potential work stoppage. That's not quite the way it's been historically. In 1997, Governor Pete Wilson did get involved. He was asked to go for a 60 or 80-day cooling-off period. He declined to do that, but he appointed a commission that took a week, that laid out a compromise plan. That, in turn, was rejected, but it bought a week. And then Mayor Willie Brown was very central in bringing the parties together and getting a settlement in 97 after 6 days. So it is possible for the governor to mandate a cooling-off period, but then it's unclear what happens at the end of that. Arbitration becomes one possibility, but in general, this time around, everyone is asking collective bargaining to take its course, at least for now. But as Rachel points out, that could change in the coming hours. But she also mentioned something else that I think is very important. Despite the very heated rhetoric and the real ups and downs in the negotiations since April, there's been a visible desire on the leadership of all three unions and by the BART board to seek to avoid a strike. And overwhelmingly, the members want to avoid a strike. So when you've got that determination, you've got some hours. There are still possibilities. It doesn't look good at this moment, but, you know, that could change very quickly.
And John Goodwin at the Metropolitan Transportation Commission, you are, after all, the agency that tries to plan and coordinate. You're the agency that distributes funding. That would seem to give you some bit of leverage in this situation. Does it? Is there anything that your commission can do to try to push any kind of settlement forward?
You know, this is an issue between BART and its unions, and not an issue where our commission can push forward a settlement. What we can do is work with the other transportation agencies around the region to try to make sure that the Bay Area transportation network operates as efficiently as it possibly can, even in the event that such a major piece as BART is down for a period of time.
All right, we're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll take your calls. What are your concerns about the BART strike possibilities? How do you view the actions that the unions are taking? And how would you like to try to figure out a way to get around the Bay Area on Monday? We'll take all that up. John Goodwin will fill us in on some of the alternatives. We'll hear from some union voices and also some of the other transit agencies that are going to try to pick up the slack during a potential BART strike. All that when we return. Here's the number if you have a point of view or a question to raise. It's 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. Back with more in just a moment. This is Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topics this hour, the two big stories that are making their way across the Bay Area this morning, the potential for a BART strike. Earlier, we also took up the topic of the wildfire currently burning in the Santa Cruz Mountains. Do you have concerns about the BART strike? Points of view about whether or not the union is doing the right thing at this point? Concerns about how you're going to get around on Monday morning? Now's the time when you can join us. It's 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Or you can email us your thoughts or questions at forum@kqed.org. That's forum@kqed.org. I want to get one other point of view engaged in our conversation this morning. That's from Gene Hamilton, who is president of AFSCME Local 3993. That's the union that represents both state, county, and municipal employees. And in the case of BART, represents about 200 mid-level supervisors, planners, accountants, safety officers. Gene Hamilton's union is one of the unions that voted, as Harley Shaken was describing earlier, in favor of the BART contract settlement, but will respect the strike that is being undertaken by one of the other unions involving BART workers, the Amalgamated Transportation Union. Gene Hamilton, give us your sense of how your union sees this. You all decided, as Harley Shaken was describing, that the contract was might not be ideal, but it was as good as it was going to get. Your membership voted overwhelmingly in favor of it. Now you're in this sort of awkward position, I would think, of having to support a strike that your own membership did not.
Well, it is an awkward position, Dave. But one of the biggest differences here that we're facing is that each union has a very different contract with the district, and the district asked each union to make some cost reductions and some work rule changes that they felt would save money. And so we each faced a different negotiation, a different impact upon our membership. And the impact in the end on my members was something we felt we could tolerate. And certainly in these economic times and watching fellow members in the state who have taken a major hit from the governor with all their furloughs, we felt we got out of this as best as we could and wanted to just get back to work and have it all settled.
Sounds like you disagree with the stance that the ATU has taken.
No, I wouldn't say I disagree. I'm just saying they had a lot of impacts related to work rules that were very different from the impact on our contract. And so they have different members, different perspectives, and a different situation that they were dealing with. And it was different from SEIU. So we each had a decision to make, and although the leaders may have felt at the end of that 24-hour binge all-nighter on the 30th that we were at a point where we could tentatively agree, it's a democratic process. You take it back to your members.
We should note, by the way, that we did invite both a representation of the ATU, the union that has called for the strike, and BART. They were unable to join us, understandably, perhaps in some ways. Hopefully they're talking to each other, if not to us. We'll let you go in just a moment, Gene Hamilton. But do you have a sense, being sort of on the inside of all of this, about whether or not there still could be resolution? Are the ATU and the BART people talking to each other informally, if not formally?
I don't know exactly whether they're talking formally. I imagine there's certainly a lot of informal conversations going on. There has been with all of us for the last 4 months. In fact, sometimes there's been more informal than formal, and that might be an issue. I would just say that I know all parties are very much interested in finding some resolution other than strike. Certainly, the unions would all prefer something other than an imposed contract. It's a bad direction to go. So I'm hopeful, all my members are hopeful, that something gets settled over the next few days and we can avert the strike. None of us want it. It's an economic impact on each one of us if we choose to honor the picket line. And it's right now it's been 4 months of just horrible work effort and a lot of animosity, and we'd like to stop it and get on the road to recovery.
Gene Hamilton, president of AFSCME Local 3993, which represents about 200 supervisors, planners, accountants, safety officers who work with BART. And the train controllers as well. All right. Gene Hamilton.
They are our heart and soul.
Right. Thank you. Thanks for being with us this morning. Hopefully there will be some resolution over the next 72 hours. Let's hear what some of the concerns of our listeners are this morning about the situation with BART. Let's go to Siva first, who joins us from San Mateo. Siva, go ahead.
Hi. notice there is no support for this strike by commuters or the general public that is, everybody is well aware in their own personal lives of economic problems. And I would applaud any kind of support that commuters could give to each other, like you talked about the Smart Line or the...
Well, there's the 511.org site where you can match up with fellow writers, also learn about both transportation alternatives as well as what the state of traffic is going to be like on Monday morning.
Okay, I would encourage entrepreneurial people who have cars and maybe don't have jobs to go to BART stations and
pick people up. That's
and
right.
Pick people up, and people have to pay to go on BART. Why shouldn't they pay car drivers?
Interesting. There's been some interesting writing, Rachel Gordon, in your paper recently about, I can't remember, necessitypreneurs, I guess. Maybe this is another opportunity for necessitypreneurs. Siva, thanks for the call. Rachel, what are you hearing about sort of commuter reaction as you follow this story? When you go online to your paper and you see the sort of reader comments that are posted after the stories, you do sense a lot of what Siva says, a lot of upset, a lot of anger, a lot of feeling, hey, we all are having difficult times. What's your sense of the degree of support for labor in this time?
I think there's a degree for support. I don't think there's for labor. I don't think there's a degree of support for striking at this point. I think the caller hit it right on the head of the nail when we were talking about everyone's kind of feeling the economic pain right now. And I think the BART Board of Directors and BART management was well aware of what's going on economically now, facing what was first considered a projected $250 million deficit. Now they're saying it's ballooned to $310 million over the next 4 years. This was a time to take advantage of take advantage of the bad economy to try to make some real structural changes to BART's escalating costs, and a lot of those costs are labor-related. We have to remember, and Professor Shaken would, I'm sure, can talk about this better than I, but that the Bay Area is a very pro-labor, pro-union region and has been traditionally. And because of that, public employees, unions in particular, have gotten pretty good deals when times are good. When times are bad, though, it's kind of coming back to haunt the agencies going, okay, how are we going to pay for these pay perks benefits that have been given out before? So I think for the public riders are going, look, I've got to get to work. I don't want to be caught in a traffic jam. I've had to give up things at my workplace, working longer hours, losing some vacation time, whenever it might be. It's a good time to capitalize on public opinion.
Rachel Gordon, who covers this story for the San Francisco Chronicle. Harley Shaken, take us inside a bit, the sort of debate within the union movement more generally. We heard Jean Hamilton from AFSCME say earlier that her members decided, in essence, it's not great, but it is a difficult time. We can live with this, even though we might not like it. What is the sort of push and pull within labor right now from the sort of point of view that we heard Jean Hamilton represent versus what we're hearing right now from the ATU that is not something that they can accept?
Oh, well, there are differences, clearly. I think workers almost universally are well aware of the pain of the current economic situation, very apprehensive of the future. That creates turmoil in terms of the overall environment. Now, the three leaders of the three unions, the AFSCME, the SEIU, and the ATU, all agreed and sought to avoid this strike. They all understood that there were painful concessions that were going to be made. In two of the three unions, the workers went along with that with overwhelming majorities. In the ATU, where the circumstances are somewhat different, as Jean Hamilton very appropriately pointed out, workers voted it down. That's far different, whatever one might agree or disagree with that, but that's far different than a broad labor strategy to go in a certain direction. So the default, the result of that, is we're on the verge of a strike right now. And at the same time, the unions are well aware, as the workers are, that there are precedents being set here that they could have to live with for a very long time, including in an improved economy. And, of course, that ratchets up the tension. Overall, though, the context is the fact that the Bay Area tends to be a union-friendly place, among the most union-friendly places in the U.S. It's always a question when you have a transit strike that people are inconvenienced But this time around, there's an added dimension that may make some less sympathetic, and that's simply they're taking hits in their own workplaces. And that, on top of the transit strike, it makes them less sympathetic than they may be under other circumstances.
And briefly, Harley Shaken, what we've heard that the contract, even though the leadership of all three approved, only two out of the three union rank and file approved. What made it worse for the train agents, the station agents rather, and the train operators, the workers who are represented by the ATU? Was there something specific about their contract that was in their view more egregious than the contract that was accepted by the rank and file by the other two?
Well, I think there may be two issues here. One is just the difference that many of the members in the ATU felt that a two-year contract would have been more appropriate. They feel the economy is going to get better within, say, 2 years, and then they would renegotiate a better agreement then. There's a risk there, which is that the economy could be bad in 2 years, and then the contract would be reopened. But that was one set of issues. But the other thing that plays into this is the work rules. They may be more significant for the ATU workers, and for many workers, it has resulted in a large chunk of overtime. Now, over a period of time, workers... all of us get used to the extra income that may come from overtime. So what you may see when you're voting on that agreement isn't simply a work rule change, but a clear cut in what you're going to be taking home.
And those overtime issues probably more in play for people who actually drive the trains, perhaps, than some of the supervisors who are represented by the by AFSCME in particular. Let's get back to our calls and see what our listeners are concerned about as the prospects for a BART strike are before us come Monday morning. Mary in Alameda joins us next. Mary, go ahead.
Sure. I just want to make sure that BART riders know that one option, a very good option for traveling to or from the East Bay to San Francisco, is AC Transit Trans-Bay service, which can be accessed through actransit.org. I've been riding it for 19 years, and it's usually very lovely and relaxing. Now, obviously, if the strike happens, the buses will be crowded since there aren't a lot of additional buses and drivers, but there are typically extra seats. And the view going over the bridge in the morning and the sunsets coming home is really exceptional.
All right. Thanks, Mary. Thanks for the recommendation. Actually, Clarence Johnson is standing by to give us an update on what AC Transit can provide as well. Mr. Johnson, thanks for taking time out. I know this is a busy time for you to plan for these contingencies, but tell us what AC Transit is going to be doing additionally to try to make up for the possibility of a BART strike.
Well, you know, it's very gratifying to hear from that rider about the joys of our service. But let me start out by saying that there's no way that any of our regional bus services can replicate what BART is doing on a daily basis. That being said, our plan is to do everything we can to keep our regular service intact. As you might imagine, we typically are jammed with riders, and our service does become quickly overwhelmed when BART is disrupted. We have about 675 buses in our fleet, and we'll put every one of them possible on the street. We do have some available capacity, primarily because public schools and the universities are still on vacation. So again, our plan is to do everything we can to make sure that our existing service runs as smoothly as possible.
And will you put actual extra buses on the line that our caller was referring to, the one that goes back and forth across the Bay Bridge?
Well, our concern is not only for the Bay Bridge. We do have local trunk lines that also become inundated with passengers and overwhelmed. So our problem, if you will be to make sure that our entire system is running smoothly. So we will be trying to provide extra service throughout our entire system, not totally to the Trans-Bay service, but certainly that will be a focus.
Clarence Johnson, spokesperson for AC Transit. Mr. Johnson, thanks. Good luck. Hope things work out well for you and your agency over the course of the next few days. John Goodwin at the Metropolitan Transportation Commission. We've heard that AC Transit will try to do a few things. What are you hearing about what other agencies are doing, whether that's Golden Gate Ferry or Muni here in San Francisco or SamTrans down on the peninsula? How is that going to work in terms of trying to make up the difference?
Well, you know, I think that Clarence spoke very well for all of the Bay Area transit agencies. they are willing and able to do what they can, but there's no way that they can replace the lost capacity of BART. So, you know, particularly in the Transbay corridor, you know, let's look at the ferries in addition to AC Transit. I expect that there will be some additional ferries put into service, both from Alameda and Oakland and from Vallejo. Those can pick up a very small fraction of the lost capacity to move people into San Francisco and back. One good thing about the ferries is that there's ample parking in Alameda and at Vallejo. And I should point out as well that bicycles are allowed on all Bay Area ferries, and that's a great way to kind of close that last mile, getting to the ferry terminal or finding your destination in San Francisco. So keep that in mind. With Muni, evidently they will be beefing up some service along those routes that parallel the BART lines. But, you know, I think that this will be a major regional inconvenience, and it's going to be felt widely throughout the region.
And at this point, John, is will the 511.org site be something that will keep – will you be constantly updating that so people will know, gee, there are extra buses online from AC Transit, here's what my options are right now? How much in real time, if people are looking this up at 7:15 in the morning come Monday, will you be able to tell people about what their best alternatives and options are?
Well, the schedules are updated as the information is provided by the transit operators. One thing that that we will do once we have definitive word that BART is not operating, we can remove BART from the online transit trip planner. So when planning a trip, it'll take BART out as an option and direct a computer user to the nearest available bus or the ferry or what have you.
John Goodwin at the Metropolitan Transportation Commission joining us this morning, along with Harley Shaken, professor from the University of California, Berkeley, and Rachel Gordon, reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. Back to our calls. Joseph in Oakland. Joseph, go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I just I wanted to just point out, I was in New York during the subway strikes, and it was really just a horrible experience. Getting to work was very difficult. If you don't get to work, you don't get paid, especially if you live in the outer boroughs. And I really appreciated the caller's advice about the AC transit, but it perturbed me that Gene Hamilton suggested that there was not a lot of formal negotiating going on between the parties. And it seems to me that the people who are paying for the product are the ones that they're not driving that negotiation. They're getting lost.
Joseph, thanks. Yeah, thanks for the call and for the concern. Joseph's call, Harley Shaken, reminds me of something that Gene Hamilton said, which I wanted to pick up on and thought you might have some observations in part about. She said at one point there's informal talks, there have been informal talks all along, and then she said, in fact, that may be part of the problem. Did you make anything of that? Can you sometimes talk too much informally and not enough formally?
Well, that can be a problem, in particular where you have minimally four entities involved. You certainly have BART, but you have three different unions with different issues, different perspectives, et cetera. In fact, you have a total of five unions, but two don't have the ability to strike. So you can get a lot of miscommunication where you have heated negotiations, as we've seen over the last 4 or 5 months.
Chris in Berkeley has a point of view on this story, too, from a self-interested and someone who is very much a part of things. Chris, go ahead.
Hi, yes, I'm a train operator with the Amalgamated Transit Union. I think it's unfortunate that BART has employed a lot of the same tactics that they've done in the past. I think the workers understand there's an economic crisis, and we weren't expecting a great contract, and we're expecting to do our share. And we know that BART also typically exaggerates their deficits. That turns out to be the case this year as well. Starting April 1st is when they projected the $250 million deficit. But looking at changes since then, we've seen that deficit come down to $75 million. But they've still been consistently portraying that number, misrepresenting that. And I think taking actions that have – they're the ones that were asking the governor to deny a cooling-off period. They've taken a couple of other actions. Traditionally, they extend the contract while we negotiate. This time, they did not do that. So puts more onus on the, or more burden on the workers.
Chris, can you give us your opinion as someone who is a train operator and I assume voted against the strike? I mean, in support of the strike, is that correct?
Well, there wasn't.
Or rejected the proposed contract.
The contract.
Okay. Given that, Professor Harley Shaken was saying earlier that one of the issues for train operators in particular was the issue of overtime, and that in the proposed contract, there would be less of that. And that's part of why perhaps your union took a different stand than the other two unions. Was that true for you? Was that a key issue?
No, that wasn't even really one of the objects or issues that was discussed. They had a number of issues that they've been going after for years, every single negotiation, and they're using the economic crisis to justify or use the support of the public understanding the economic crisis to go after some of the same issues. And it was more, a couple of the key ones were the ability of the unions to protect the contract that we do negotiate. So they were trying to cut the amount of union business that we have. When the district violates the contract, we have union representatives who represent members and try to they're like lawyers that uphold the contract. And so they're trying to reduce that ability. They're trying to reduce some of the protective language that we have. And okay, these aren't financial issues as such.
All right, Chris, thanks. I appreciate your putting in your point of view this morning. Important to hear from your union in particular. Rachel, what about Chris's point about the sort of status of the BART deficit? What can you tell us about what's real about that and how much that's driving the current circumstances?
I think that there's no doubt that BART's money, as transit agencies across the state and the nation are feeling that there's economic hemorrhaging, and California has been hit, seems particularly hard because Sacramento has decided to take a lot of money, operating funds that have been earmarked for transit agencies to help balance the state budget. The transit operators will say it's raiding the money. The governor's office will say something differently about that. When you talk about the projected budget deficit, it is a moving target. BART is saying that it had a $250 million deficit over 4 years. Now it's up to $310 million. When some people are saying, well, that deficit's really not as high, part of the reason is because cost-cutting measures or revenue-making measures have already been enacted, which helps to kind of whittle down that budget. For example, BART raised fares on July 1st, so that takes care of some of the budget problem right there by bringing in more revenue. Service is going to be cut come September, nights and weekends, and that's going to take away some of that thing. So just by making those reductions, BART also is saying it's making internal adjustments. I'm not an actuary. I've not actually pored through the books. I, as a member of the public, have looked at the budget documents, and it's sometimes a he said, she said kind of, debate going on there. But there's no doubt that the budget is really hurting right now with sales tax revenue, property tax revenue going down that transit agencies rely on, and really we're seeing a big drop in faregate revenue as ridership has dropped off dramatically. And BART, it seems more than almost any other transit agency, at least in the Bay Area, is really affected by the economy. When unemployment is high, BART ridership goes down.
Richard raises this question, and Rachel, either you or Harley or John can chime in with an answer. And Richard raises this interesting question about even if BART collects no revenue during the strike, if they are not paying any labor costs, they might actually save money. In other words, the strike might cause their deficit to go down. Does that make sense, Harley?
No. It has a certain intuitive appeal, but this is a very capital-intensive industry. They still have to pay, in effect, you know, for the trains, for a whole bunch of fixed costs that are a burden while they're out. And, of course, the larger economic impact is what's caused the broad public concern.
To Phil in Burlingame with our next question. Phil, go ahead, please.
Hi. Because this is public transit, and can't a judge step in and hold off the strike? I mean, it seems like the public harm is offset, and it's a special area of the law.
Phil, thanks. Harley Shaken?
That could happen, but there's a process. BART Board has declared the impasse, but the governor has chosen not to go ahead by taking this to court, in effect saying, let collective bargaining run its course. That may indicate that there's a glimmer of hope from the governor's office that a settlement is still possible, and he'd prefer to see that take place prior to intervening. Also, we haven't seen the kind of intervention, say, of a mayor of Willie Brown in 1997, the informal intervention of a major public figure.
One more point of view we'll get this morning from Josh in Alameda. Josh, I'm afraid we're short on time. Just a quick thought, please.
Well, I just wanted to mention that, you know, I'm a son of a union member myself and had all my benefits from unions, and I certainly appreciate them. But in these times, I mean, notwithstanding the comments that the train operator mentioned previously, I don't think there's going to be a lot of public support for this strike this time around. And I remember the last one in 97 and being in a crush of traffic over the Bay Bridge. And, you know, I think that there's a general perception out there that train operators aren't terribly necessary in the BART system, that much of the control is done by computers. So just wanted to add that little thought there.
Josh, thanks. Thanks for the call. One, just a couple of other quick things that John Goodwin, maybe you can help us with. Lynn writes in, how is the message to carpool, telecommute, or avoid peak commute times being commuted to the Bay Area's non-English speaking community?
That's a great question. And since I only speak English or only speak English well, I'm not doing my job in communicating that message. But we hope that our outreach to the media will be extended to the non-English media, and that our messaging will be translated, if you will.
All right, John Goodwin, thanks. Thanks, too, to Rachel Gordon for being part of our program and to Professor Harley Shaken for adding his insight into how the labor unions work. Earlier today, we also heard from Gene Hamilton of AFSCME and Clarence Johnson from AC Transit. Thanks all very much for adding your point of view. We'll be following the story, of course, throughout the day here on KQED, and we'll update it as necessary Monday morning on Forum. Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory, Tina Lauerberg, and Judy Campbell, our engineer this hour, Danny Bringer. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Coming up in our second hour, we'll talk with Sheila and Lisa Himmel about their revealing new book called Hungry. It details one family's struggle with eating disorders. That conversation coming up in our second hour. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.